the first degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
First degree.
The first degree.
These things are supposed to happen in movies, not in real life.
It was a shock to me even then, just like, oh my God, this guy has been bad news for so long, and I had no idea, not a single idea.
Welcome to The First Degree, the true crime podcast that you might end up on. My name is Jack Fanick. I'm sitting far away from Alexis Linkletter and Billy Jensen. And today is part two of the Peter Porco case. So if you haven't listened to part one, you're going to be real fucking confused. So go back, listen to part one, binge part two, and it'll just be a glorious day.
Truly glorious.
Truly glorious. Before we begin, I just want to give a little reminder that if you haven't left us a review on iTunes and you like our podcast, can you please leave us a nice little 5-star review and write something nice to us so we can know that you care about what we're doing?
It'll bring morale up for us.
It will.
Yes. We need it. So thank you in advance.
We're not that low. Sometimes
speak for yourself.
Yeah.
Please 5-star review for Alexis Linkletter's
sad self-esteem.
Sadsies. And then, I don't know, you can join our Facebook group. We're talking true crime all the time over there. Right, guys?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. All right, Billy, what day is it today?
Today is July 28th, and it is National Hamburger Day.
It's a fantastic day.
Now, I will say, I want to ask you ladies this.
Yes.
And this is probably something we could do on Instagram or the Facebook group as well. Favorite hamburger from a national chain?
In-N-Out.
Shake Shack.
I'm going with Shake Shack as well.
Oh, I feel like we've had this debate before.
In-N-Out's better, guys.
Mm. No.
Yeah.
No. Mm.
There's a Shake Shack right up the street from me that I could have in 1 minute, and I would rather wait in like a 2-hour line.
Oh, see, I mean, I think it depends on what type of a burger person you are. Like, I am a smash, melty, smushy burger type of a gal, and In-N-Out, I love In-N-Out.
In-N-Out's so good.
It's so good. They're just different. They satisfy you in different levels and different days. Like, you have an In-N-Out day, a Shake Shack day, but I think all in all, Shake Shack with the crinkle cut fries, a root beer, it's consistent. In-N-Out sometimes is a little bit watery.
Mm-hmm. I love In-N-Out all the time. I also love Shake Shack. This is not a Shake Shack throw shade situation. I love a Shake Shack. And I love that they have a chicken sandwich, so you can get both and have like a few bites of each.
Mm. Yes.
I'm here for Shake Shack too. There's nothing like an In-N-Out cheeseburger with extra cheese and grilled onions.
And there's nothing like an animal fry.
Nothing. And there's then you get a Neapolitan shake and suddenly you're in Nirvana. Yeah.
Yes, it's true. I mean, I love them both. I freaking love a good hamburger, cheeseburger. Yeah.
No, people who don't put cheese on a burger, it's very sacrilegious.
Yeah. My mom doesn't.
Neither does my mom. Always calls them hamburgers. I'm like, you mean cheeseburger, right? Like,
no, my mom literally doesn't. She takes the cheese off of the cheeseburger. I don't know. I don't understand.
But she
mom.
Likes cheese.
I know. It doesn't make sense.
I've seen her house a cheese plate in a good way.
Blasphemy.
Yes.
Billy, there is another fantastic day that we need to talk about.
National Milk Chocolate Day?
Yes.
Ooh.
Okay.
Oh, I thought it was just National Chocolate Day.
No, it's Milk Chocolate Day. They are specifically saying National Milk Chocolate Day. And milk chocolate was, when I was a kid, that was the only chocolate that was around, unless you happened to get the special dark chocolate on Halloween and you were like, what is this? This is too bitter. Now, when you say chocolate, everybody likes the dark chocolate, but milk chocolate trying to make a comeback here with National Milk Chocolate Day.
I'm equal opportunist for chocolates, except white chocolate.
No, white chocolate's not. That's not really chocolate.
I like it. I like the Oreo bar.
I do too.
Cream bar. That's a good bar.
Love that bar, but I don't like white chocolate either. But sometimes,
Jacqueline, you're a woman of my own heart.
Sometimes I'll get that bar over any other candy. I'm like, what am I doing?
Because Oreos are amazing. Like, they are. Oreos are so fucking good.
There's a great writer named Steve Almond. He did a book called Candy Freak, and it's all about candy throughout history. And he says that white chocolate is an abomination. It's not even chocolate.
It's not even chocolate.
It's like vanilla chocolate. Yeah,
it's like a vanilla bar. Because I don't think there's any like cacao in it. Anyways, this is for a different podcast.
And this is something, and this is for more of a Killing Time thing, but it's also National Water Park Day. And I think water park is going to be something that is going to go on the stand at some point.
Yeah, save that, Billy, because I feel like that's a good discussion.
It is.
Tune into Killing Time. All right, well, that's enough of that. So let's turn down the lights.
and turn up your anxiety.
Because this...
Last week, we introduced you to the Porco family, which consisted of a happily married couple in the early 50s, Peter and Joan, their two sons, 19-year-old Chris and 22-year-old Jonathan. For the most part, they seemed like your typical suburban family living in the small town of Del Mar, New York, which is near Albany. But on the morning of November 15th, 2004, Peter was found dead in the home, struck more than a dozen times with an axe. His wife, Joan, had been hit three times. And thankfully, she miraculously survived. Joan clung to life as detectives arrived on scene. And when one detective asked Joan if her son Chris was responsible for this murderous attack, she nodded yes. Joan fell into a medically induced coma for 3 weeks. And in a plot twist, when she awoke, she told the police that her son Chris had not done this. The only problem was that there was pretty significant evidence that suggested otherwise. This leaves us with the question, was Joan now denying her son was responsible because the truth of his attack on his parents was too emotionally painful for her to accept? Or was there a chance that Chris wasn't actually their guy?
Joan's post-coma denial of Chris as her and her husband's attacker was a blow to the investigation. And the investigators struggled with their new position, especially because on the day it happened, the paramedics had determined that Joan was definitely aware of what was happening at the crime scene. She had answered yes or no correctly several times before she confirmed Chris as the person who murdered her husband and nearly killed her as well. The police believed Chris was responsible for this, but they didn't yet have the evidence to secure an arrest. So Chris remained free as police worked to build their case against him.
We still have our first degree Alex with us to help us move through this story. And she recalls that this unfolding case was the talk of the town. And while she was living in New York City attending college, her parents were still in Del Mar.
I remember my parents mentioning that as that was happening. Like, Joan is now saying that it wasn't Chris, but when she initially went into the hospital, she was saying it was him. So that was sort of like the most shocking part of the whole situation, was that, you know, we all thought like, oh, his mom is blaming him. Obviously this is going to go down fine. Like, he's going to get caught. He's going to go to jail. It's all going to be like, justice will be served. And then she changed her story.
On some level, I think we can all feel for Joan. If she truly didn't remember the attack when she woke up, obviously that is horrible. But even if she did, we'd also understand not having that psychological capacity to accept that your son, the person who you raised and nurtured, could do this to you. You know, our minds work in mysterious ways and are equipped with countless defense mechanisms. So you have to just think of the pain. And regardless of Joan's story or position on her son's involvement in her attack, she is a true victim, and we should approach her decisions with compassion and understanding.
Absolutely. All true. Whatever Joan does, she's entitled to do because she's coping in whatever way she needs to. But as far as Joan's new position, there was a big problem from an investigative standpoint. And that problem is that there was so much evidence pointing to Chris as the guilty party. There was surveillance footage proving that Chris left his college campus at the times that aligned with his parents' attack. Then, the intruder knew the security code to the house, and they had activated the security code before smashing the panel for the alarm when his parents were attacked. Sure, this was circumstantial evidence, but one of the most important things when considering whether someone close to a murder victim, or in this case, Joan, is responsible, is motive. And there's a big question mark there. Why the fuck would Chris have done this to his parents in the first place? Our first degree Alex had the same questions. Chris's name was swirling around as the prime suspect in this unthinkable attack. But why? Why did people think he was capable of this?
Like, what are you talking about? Like, why would this person, how and why could this have possibly happened with this person? After he graduated, I knew that some girls from my grade were still in touch with him. Somehow, I guess I totally missed this in my own, like, high school self-loathing bubble that I was in, missed the relationship that he had with so many other people, but it had slowly come out that, like, he was kind of a player and was playing, like, a lot of younger girls, like, people who were in my grade, and was just, like, lying to them and being shady with them. But I never associated that with anything more serious than him just being, like, a shitty teenage dude.
We all know those guys in high school. And actually, most high school guys either were players or they wish they were players. So to me, nothing about this really screams homicidal maniac, at least not outwardly.
I never saw this coming. And when I found out, it was a super shock. And even as I was researching this in the more recent past, reading all of that stuff, it was a shock to me even then. Just like, oh my God, this guy has been bad news for so long. And I had no idea, not a single idea.
Did you catch the last thing that Alex said? So Chris had, quote unquote, been bad news for so long. So little did anybody know, Chris was a prolific liar. He was a hopeless narcissist, extraordinarily deceptive and manipulative. And as it turns out, he possessed the type of evil that made him capable of killing his own parents.
As investigators worked the case and a cloud of suspicion hovered over Chris, weeks started to pass. And with each passing day of Joan's recovery, she became more and more staunchly convinced that her son Chris had absolutely nothing to do with murdering his father, her husband, or attacking her. She was actively advocating for his innocence. She wrote letters to the local newspaper, the Times Union, asking police to, quote, "I implore the Bethlehem police and the district attorney's office to leave my son alone and to search for Peter's real killer or killers, so that he can rest in peace and my sons and I can live in safety." Joan was determined to end the investigation into her son.
Okay, this is a predicament, and I feel really bad for Joan because I do believe that she believed it. You know, I think she could not accept the truth here, and I'm sure the cops felt for her too. But everyone was fairly certain that it was in fact Chris who had done this, especially one of the lead investigators, Detective Bodish, who has been involved in this since day one. So Bodish was the key investigator in this case, and he reported to the Porker residence 2 years prior to the attack when Joan and Peter had this burglary at their home. He remembered the Porkos on the day of the attack and had been the one to ask Joan if Chris had done this to her, in which she responded with nodding her head yes. Bodish, the smart man that he was, started to wonder if this burglary 2 years prior could be connected to Peter and Joan's attack. So he opened his files back up, and miraculously, he started digging in, and he was able to trace the stolen laptop from this burglary to a man from San Diego who had bought this laptop on eBay a few weeks after the break-in occurred. The kicker is, he bought it from Chris. It traced back to Chris's eBay account.
Ugh.
Wow.
I know, it's super yike. It's like 2 years even before he attacked his parents, he's like deceiving them in the most insane way. It's just, it's so icky and sad to me.
And it's also just like straight, right? He's not doing this with any thought about probably what happens if somebody looks into this and tries to trace back a purchase. Like, where would it be? Mm-hmm. So it's kind of haphazard and just sloppy on his end. And it's so fucked up.
No, he's looking at this. Oh, there's this, you know, fairly new thing, eBay. I can make money on this. What could I sell? He probably sold some stuff of his at one point, and then he's just like looked around, and then he creates this ruse, which frightens a family.
I know. The lengths that you're going to go to make, what, $500 off of a laptop? Yeah. Not even. I mean, that's so horrible.
Even scarier, guys, you guys are thinking like, oh, eBay, he's looking at this new thing. What's even scarier to me is that I feel like this is just his second nature. I feel like he does
Oh yeah.
every day, what he can do to get the most out of people. That's how sociopaths operate. Yeah. Like, how can I exploit people today to make my life easier?
I mean, it's textbook sociopathic behavior where everybody around you is a pawn. Like, he's not thinking of his parents as like loving individuals that he should care for. He's thinking of them as, you know, chess pieces of how he could take advantage of to mm-hmm. benefit himself.
That's right.
So what we now know is that Chris is capable of faking a burglary to rob items from his own parents. But now the question is he capable of murder? Doing something like this doesn't bode well for his character.
When I heard about it or read about it, it was like a passing note and like, oh, he also did this, by the way. Like, this was not the first time he was shitty. I guess he tried to do it without killing his parents first. And when that wasn't going to work, like, well, I guess we'll just finish the job. Like, I guess that's what narcissists do, though. It's like they just feel that everything is owed to them and they do what they need to do to get what it is they feel is owed to them.
So from the vantage point of investigators, Chris's guilt was being proven more and more with each piece of evidence that they unearthed. But unfortunately, they were met with more and more obstacles. The local paper started getting anonymous letters from a person who was claiming to be the murderer. And in these letters, this phantom writer, he was bragging about what they had done. And they also took credit for a second unsolved murder in the area. The police took fingerprints and they could find nothing on the letters. So this is a mindfuck that is artfully designed to mess with the investigation. And I'm sure it worked. I mean, they had to take it seriously to some degree. And it's unclear as to what the police made of these letters. Was this just some idiot who was bored and inserting themselves for the amusement of the case? It wouldn't be the first time. Or did they think that they were from Chris? And maybe he was trying to fabricate some type of a red herring to get the attention off of himself. And while it was anybody's guess, none of this distracted the police from their focus. They were going to prove that Chris Porco had murdered his father and tried to murder his mother.
Investigators then uncovered the fact that a second burglary had actually occurred at the Porco home in July of 2003. And during the second burglary, this time Peter Porco's laptop was stolen. The intruder made entrance through a torn window screen in the front of the house. Chris had actually been home when this one happened too. And when the police were called by his parents, he was questioned. He told them he had been sleeping and he hadn't heard a thing. But get this. Records connected to his eBay account were pulled, and it was revealed that he listed the laptop for sale on eBay that very same day.
I feel bad when I don't say, like, thank you to my parents for a gift or something. And it's like, the depth of his, like, entitlement to their things and just, like, the lack of consideration for them is some scummy shit.
Yeah, it is scummy as fuck.
So then, the police were made aware of yet another suspicious burglary in 2003. Only this time, it hadn't occurred at the Porco home. It had happened at a business. It was the Bethlehem Veterinary Clinic. So you may be wondering, how in the world could this be connected to the Porco attack? Well, here's your answer. Chris used to work at this veterinary clinic. And apparently, after this burglary, it was revealed that the intruder got away with a digital camera, a camcorder, pocket computers, and a cell phone. Once again, these items miraculously popped up for sale on Chris's eBay account just weeks after the burglary. The digital camera was actually eventually recovered, and the buyer confirmed that yes, he had in fact purchased this camera from Chris's eBay account.
And there is more. So the cell phone taken from this vet's office had actually been recovered, and police found it locked in Chris's personal safe that he kept in his room at his parents' house. So the audacity of Chris at this point is fucking insane. And either way, we know that generally burglaries are not investigated super thoroughly by police departments because they usually have other priorities going on. And this is why these crimes weren't connected back to Chris prior when they occurred. And these burglaries were certainly evidence of Chris's shitty fucking morals, but were they evidence that he was in fact a murderer? And here's another question. Why did Chris commit these burglaries at all? Was he some kind of a thrill seeker, or did he need money for some reason? We're going to get to that answer shortly.
It's no doubt that Chris's behavior in his hometown of Del Mar was disturbing. But what about his behavior at college? Now, here's what we know. Chris began his college career at the University of Rochester in the fall of 2002. And once he arrived, Chris decided that he was going to reinvent himself. And that's not that different. You know, college is a place where you can become completely different. You're finally away from people that you very often you grew up with your entire lives. They know all the weird secrets about you. He's going to do something different. But this is what he does. He starts telling all of his peers that he's a millionaire. He claims that his grandmother left him an inheritance worth millions of dollars. And he also told his classmates that his family had oceanfront homes in the Outer Banks, as well as other million-dollar investments.
This is some Andrew Cunanan shit, if I've ever seen it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
like,
it
this
really
is such a earmark of a narcissist, where it's like you have to project some vision of success and riches or whatever, and then you commit heinous acts to keep up with the Joneses. Like, we see this a lot.
Yeah, we see it. Nothing matters to him more than keeping up this facade of his new millionaire status to his peer. Like, that is probably the most important thing to him, and he will go to any extent to make this happen.
And mm-hmm. you know, he's like just buying rounds of shots at shitty college bars, and like that's what he's probably spending money on and needing to try to keep up for appearances. But
yeah, and people are liking him. People are hoping that, oh, you know, maybe I'll get an invite to that oceanfront home for a weekend or something. I'm sure he's throwing out all of these kind of things.
Yeah, fucking so bullshit, people are fabricated invites to places. Yeah,
totally. But hey, it's no surprise that Chris's invented fabricated millions couldn't buy him good grades. And for some reason, although he had been an excellent student in high school, scoring amazing on his SATs, he was failing his college courses miserably. And he was ultimately expelled from the University of Rochester as a result. Again, this guy killed it. He tested really well in high school, so this isn't adding up. So he's kicked out of the University of Rochester, and then he enrolls in Hudson Valley Community College in Troy, New York. So he goes to community college to sort of try to pick up the pieces, I guess. And this place is much closer to home and just outside Albany County. And Albany is where Del Mar is close to. So here's the thing. He fails out of these classes as well. He fails out of community college. And Chris's parents were just like devastated and not understanding their son's inexplicable behavior. A guy who had been the swim team captain, a guy who had all this promise. It was all being squandered. And Joan and Peter exchange emails with Chris regularly about it. In one such email, Peter wrote to his son, and side note is Chris was in England on vacation at the time. He says, "You just left and we can't believe our eyes as we look at your interim grade report. You know what they say, 3 strikes and you're out. Explain yourself."
And at this point, according to court documents, Chris needed a plan to appease his parents and somehow get himself back into school. So days later from this email, Chris ended up forging a college transcript and he put 3 A's and 1 B for his spring semester grades at Hudson Valley. He attached this fake transcript to an email to his dad and said, quote, "Obviously they're incorrect. Don't jump to conclusions. I'm fine." So then Chris doubles down on this fake transcript. And in August of 2004, he sent it to the University of Rochester and they reinstated him back into university. So he is literally manipulating everybody in his life and honestly getting his way.
So how big of a role is money playing in all of this? Well, the investigation followed the money and they uncovered that in October of 2004, Chris asked his dad for help to take out a loan of $2,000 for school expenses. So Peter sends his son his work documents and tax documents and agrees to co-sign for the loan. And that should have been the end of it. But this is Chris. And Chris decided to exploit his father's generosity and trust. And he used his father's paperwork to take out an additional $31,000 loan from Citibank.
Of course, Peter would have found out about this eventually. And the police wondered if this could have been Chris's motive for needing to get rid of his father. Was this a catalyst? So less than a month later, to Peter's surprise, but no surprise to us, he received a letter from Citibank about this mysterious large loan, which had been approved. He's shocked and he's angry. He immediately calls, he cancels it. Then he runs this credit report, and it reveals not just the two loans that had been taken out by his son, but also that Chris has forged his father's signature on a $16,450 check that he used to buy his yellow Jeep that we've mentioned several times throughout this episode. Okay, so prior to this revelation, Chris's parents had believed that the Jeep had been given to Chris by a friend or a client. It's unclear. But no, this was yet another lie concocted by their son, exploiting them.
So the day after this information surfaced and Peter became aware of his son's betrayals, Peter, in a furious rage, emails his son about the forged loans. Peter wrote in part, quote, "Did you forge my signature as a co-signer? What the hell are you doing? You should have called me to discuss it. I want you to know that if you abuse my credit again, I will be forced to file forgery affidavits in order to disclaim liability, and that applies to the Citibank college loan if you attempt to reactivate it or use my credit to obtain another loan." And at the end of this email, Peter writes, quote, "We may be disappointed in you, but your mother and I still love you and care about your future."
You know, a father's love, a parent's love for their child. The fact that Peter says that loving remark at the end just shows, you know, he was a great father. He just wanted things to work. He wanted things to be the best for his kid. You know, his son just tried to financially screw him over, and Peter is still trying to help him and loves him and takes him in with open arms.
My parents definitely would have responded to that sort of email like, "Listen, we love you, but you're going to have to face the consequences of this tough shit. You made your bed, lay in it." You know, like, "We still love you, but you done fucked up and now you're going to have to pay the price."
I got to tell you, my parents would have told me to go F myself. If I had pulled some shit like that, they probably would have pressed charges. Just because you don't do that. I think it would have been such a red flag for me to do something like that, that it's like, I wouldn't have blamed them either. The level of deception.
It just shows what a patient, kind man he is. That takes a special type of a person to react to such fucked up behavior from your child. Like deception, lies, deceit, fraud, all of that shit. And to be like, "We still love you and we still want to help you." That is insane.
And I know that people are, because I thought this as well. And it goes back to the mom saying he didn't do it. Was this kid given way too long of a leash? Was he consistently allowed to do things throughout his life that potentially might have? And you don't want to ever put blame and victim blame or whatever, because at the end of the day, you're always going to want to let your kids do stuff.
I don't even think it's that. I don't know. We weren't there to know. But if you've ever dealt with a psychopathic person in your life, their manipulation runs so fucking deep.
You think you're crazy. You think you're crazy.
Well, it's crazy making, and it's the gaslighting, and he's gaslighting his parents and making them feel probably like the bad guy. And it's just a sign of a really fucking good psychopath. Like, that's what it is. That they still want, at the end of the day, they want to do the right thing and they love him and want to help him.
Exactly. And he very well might have just been wired like that. And it wasn't, you know, it was...
Oh, no, he was wired like that.
Not the nurture. Yeah.
I mean, his parents sound so kind.
His parents could have disciplined him and done anything they wanted to him. He still would have come out the same way.
Yeah, he's going to fuck everybody over along his way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So here's something else to show you the type of father that Peter was. During this money confusion, it was revealed the university never paid for his tuition for the 2004 fall semester. On November 9th, Peter actually secured a new loan through the school to cover Chris's education for that whole semester. Peter emailed his son, "We can discuss payment of the spring semester when we see you at Thanksgiving." Now, during this email exchange, Joan also reached out to Chris. Now, apparently Chris had refused to give his parents a number to contact him at college, which is so ridiculous, so awful.
And they're paying for it.
Bizarre.
Yeah. Email would have been the primary method of communication between them. And I remember, you know, yes, this is before texting, but like, I talked to my dad almost every day in college. She writes, "Dad and I are very upset about your not communicating with us. We don't know if you are well or mentally stable. Dad is about to have a nervous breakdown. Do you understand that you are not behaving responsibly? If you don't call, I will be there to see you tomorrow. For God's sakes, call Mom."
Isn't it funny that his like refusal to not have a phone to talk to them on the phone is probably his downfall because all this shit is fucking documented?
Yeah, the irony, you know, it's like, and it makes you wonder what he, if he was planning it or like, he's smart and all, but he didn't take the bigger picture into consideration.
No.
He's not smart. He's manipulative. He's not smart. All of the things he's done is stupid.
He didn't get arrested for like a year. So, I mean, he's smarter than most people who get arrested right away.
Well, the bottom line is he didn't leave any of his DNA or fingerprints or anything like that on the murder weapon or on, you know, close to the bodies that would have been, post or during the assault. But there's so many dumb things that he did, from the eBay to the toll booth ticket.
He never expected the burglaries to be connected to the event. He thought they were such petty crimes that like they wouldn't be brought up. They were like, burglaries just happened, but they don't.
Definitely not twice
or three times plus somebody's employer. But anyways, all this evidence we're referencing, all this evidence police are collecting, it's all for the sake of pinning Chris to the wall because they believe that he is responsible. So the last bit of info the police uncover is just how much this now 22-year-old was in debt. And the numbers might shock you. So Chris owed $3,600 to eBay for selling items that he never sent to buyers. In one particular instance, Chris sent an email to a buyer as a guy named David Porco, Chris's fake brother that doesn't exist. He told the buyer that Chris had in fact been killed in a car accident, which is why she'd not received the computer she bought from him.
Insane. That is so crazy. Okay, so that's not all. We're going to total up what Chris owes. So $4,000 to American Express, $14,000 to Capital One Auto related to his Jeep loan, $250 for his Sprint phone bill, $16,000 to the University of Rochester, which his father had signed a loan for prior to his death. So in total, this is over $34,000 in debt. And again, he's 22 years old. And at the time of the murder, Chris had $1.93 in his savings account and a negative $115 in his checking.
Chris had racked up all of this debt simply because he wanted to impress his college friends. He needed to keep up this elaborate lie that he was a millionaire.
I think what the most disgusting thing about the whole situation is that it all comes down to money, you know, and it's like, it's a tale as old as time. Like, why do crimes get committed? For money or sex? Like one or the other, sometimes both. Chris was trying to live above his means. He was being extremely like sociopathic and narcissistic and just like the only thing important to him was his image. He was spending money faster than he could get it. And that's the most disgusting thing about it is like you literally decided that the only way to get the money that you felt you need or was owed to you for whatever sick reason was by committing murder. Like, what?
And Chris didn't just commit any murder. He murdered his father and tried to kill his mother. And that's exactly what state prosecutors intended to prove to a grand jury. Finally, law enforcement believed they had enough evidence to file charges against Chris. They took all the information they had gathered about Chris's Jeep, seen in the surveillance video. They got the testimony from college friends, the burglaries, the emails between his parents, and everything else to mold a narrative and prove that Chris had motive. And they intended to demonstrate that Chris was not only a murderer, but a sociopath as well.
It's still so mind-blowing to me that like this guy who was raised in a nice neighborhood, went to a great school, just decided that he wasn't getting what he wanted, so he was going to shed blood to do it. There's so many other answers, man. Like, take out a loan, get a job. The first thought of like, how do I get the money that I've decided I needed shouldn't be like, ooh, I guess maybe I'll kill someone for it.
Then, almost exactly a year to the day after Peter's murder and Joan's attack, the prosecution presented their evidence. Chris attended the proceeding, and his mother, Joan, joined him and sat by his side. Chris Porco had been the sole suspect in his parents' fatal assault, which took the life of his father and almost stole the life of his mother as well. A cloud of suspicion hovered over him for nearly a year, but the police did not give up. and painstakingly uncovered indisputable evidence of Chris's betrayal of his parents, all of which painted a clear picture of motive, means, and opportunity. Finally, almost a year later, Chris was charged with the second-degree murder of his father and the attempted second-degree murder of his mother. I do think it's odd that he's charged with second degree, considering the planning.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the extensive planning.
Yeah, better that than nothing, I guess.
Yeah, that is
probably because they didn't have DNA. They were like, let's go for the last. Like, we could prove this a lot easier than first. The stakes are higher with first degree. So it was probably like a strategic decision.
Yeah. So Chris's bail was set at $250,000. But with the support of his mother, his brother, and ironically, the owners of the veterinary clinic that he stole items from, which is so mind-blowing, he was able to post bail and walk free.
This just demonstrates, though, the fact that the veterinary clinic owner is like, I'll post some bail. It's like, it just mm-hmm. demonstrates his manipulation, yeah. the depths of it, how skilled he is.
These people are still on his side when there is hard evidence that he has fucked all of them over. Mm-hmm. They're all still like, yep, my dude, gotcha.
Yeah, homies for life.
Dude.
Ugh. Yikes.
So a month later, Joan would tape a video deposition and send it to the grand jury. And this would be her last act of desperation in an effort to help her son before he stood trial. She reiterated that Chris was not her attacker. And Alex says that this was the most confusing part of the entire case.
That's kind of what threw everyone for a loop as the trial was happening, was like, oh, now she's like walking arm in arm with her son and defending him to the very end. And I think even to this day, she is still claiming that he's innocent, and he is still claiming his innocence because he's a psycho. That at the time was like the most shocking part of it.
But Joan's pleas fell on deaf ears, because by May of 2006, Chris was walking arm in arm with his mom into an Albany courtroom for proceedings to begin. During the pretrial hearing, both the defense and the prosecution had some specific requests for the trial. The defense wanted to deny any testimony pertaining to Chris's interrogation. And the reason cited was because Chris was denied counsel, and apparently there was evidence that this had actually occurred, because the judge agreed.
The defense also requested that the trial be moved to another jurisdiction, due to the intense media coverage the case had received in the year prior.
Authorities want to question one of their two sons, Christopher, a student at the University of Rochester.
In addition to news coverage, Forensic Files produced an episode, as did 48 Hours. And maybe this is a shocker, maybe it's not, but Chris, the narcissist that he was, actually granted 48 Hours an interview. Here's a clip from the show.
This is a question that people would want me to ask you directly. Did you drive over to your parents' house, go up into their bedroom, attack them with an axe, killing your father and gravely wounding your mother?
I can't say it enough that absolutely no. I would never do anything like that to anyone, let alone my parents, who I love dearly.
So with all the aforementioned media coverage, the judge agreed that it was in fact necessary for the trial to be moved to a new venue. It was the only way Chris could get a fair trial. So the case was to be tried in Goshen, New York, almost 2 hours south of Albany.
Another topic up for debate was Joan identifying Chris as her attacker, Detective Bodish. The defense wanted that piece of evidence thrown out because her story contradicted a statement she'd later make, which is that he wasn't the attacker. The defense felt her head nods to Detective Bodish were not sufficient communication. However, in the end, the judge sided with the prosecution and allowed Joan's original statement in the form of head nods to remain as evidence in the trial.
So the trial kicked off in July of 2006 with Joan and Chris's brother Jonathan sitting directly behind Chris in support. The prosecution laid out their case against Chris, and this included him being a lying, cheating, scheming sociopath who, prior to attacking his parents, staged several burglaries to steal from them and sell their items for money to fuel a fake lifestyle he feigned to his college friends. And prosecutors claimed that Chris's motive to murder his parents was because they had uncovered all of his lies, and Chris had no way out of these walls that were closing in on him. And not only that, if Chris's parents were killed, Chris would now inherit
all that they owned. And this would clear all of his debts and give him more money on top of that.
The state presented a witness in the form of one of the Porcos' neighbors. And their testimony was not good for Chris. They claimed that at around 4 a.m. on the night of Peter Porco's murder and the attack on Joan, they saw Chris's yellow Jeep parked in the family's driveway. And that fits the prosecution's timeline of where Chris was after his Jeep was seen leaving the school at 10:30 the night before and arriving back at school at 8:30 the following morning.
The defense worked to discredit Detective Bowdish's initial exchange with Joan at the scene following her attack. They claim that Joan would not have been cognizant enough to identify Chris as her attacker in her brutalized state. Additionally, two of the other lead detectives on the case, very unfortunately, had passed away since this attack had occurred, and they were the only other ones on scene who would have been able to corroborate Bowdish's testimony. The defense also attempted to discredit the Bethlehem Police Department as a whole, claiming that officers failed to consider other suspects. They only focused on Chris.
The defense's strategy was essentially to place blame at the feet of quote-unquote other suspects who had not been investigated at all. And if you recall, Peter Porco worked as a law clerk at the Albany County Courthouse. So the defense had learned that some disgruntled defendants had thrown threats towards Peter in the past. And one such defendant vowed to get revenge against Peter and the judge during a custody case that didn't go in his favor. So the defense was suggesting that this guy could have been the person responsible for this crime. So the prosecution countered, and the guy had actually been looked into, and the former defendant had an alibi for the night of the attack.
The defense wasn't done. They then introduced their most explosive allegation yet. They pointed to another member of the Porco family as the possible perpetrator, or the possible reason why this happened. He was known as Frank the Fireman Porco, and he was Peter's great uncle. Now, Frank worked as a fireman for 20 years, which explains the nickname, but it also connects the fireman's axe that was used as a weapon during the attack. But why would Frank want to hurt his nephew Peter or his wife Joan? You see, Frank was a well-known captain of New York's notorious Bonanno crime family, and they really had a hold on the city dating back to the 1890s. 2 years before Peter's murder, Frank had pleaded guilty to a conspiracy to commit murder charge.
Yes, and Frank had also been implicated on charges of loan sharking and racketeering and had been sentenced to 2 years in federal prison. That sounds pretty light for someone facing conspiracy to commit murder charges as well as racketeering and loan sharking. And because of this, many believe that this very light sentence may have been the result of Frank snitching on other Bonanno family members. So the defense suggested that Frank's snitching could have been the motive for someone to want to seek revenge. That being said, I don't know anyone who would go after a great nephew as like, I'm going to hit him where it hurts. I'm going to get his great nephew. I know my great aunt, and like, I wouldn't be the worst person for them to go after if they wanted to hurt her.
It's a bit of a reach, I think.
Right. There's many people closer to her or to this great uncle, right, that would hurt more. It's a real stretch, in my opinion.
Yeah. Huge stretch. Prosecutors debunked these theories, and they noted that the police visited Frank in prison after Peter's murder, and they learned that he was in good standing with the Bonanno family. So it makes no sense that any would come after Frank's family. And do we need to talk about the fact that Chris is the kind of guy who, on top of murdering his parents, would also attempt to frame a family member for something this horrific? Did he choose the axe as the murder weapon specifically for this reason? I don't know, but it is truly disgusting.
Probably. He probably thinks he's pretty smart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like probably if he's willing to kill his dad, he's definitely willing to frame his great uncle.
Yeah. Wouldn't be the worst thing he's done.
I think he absolutely did.
For sure. Yeah. It was like, ooh, I'm so smart. I got it. I'll use an axe from my own garage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then there was some much awaited testimony from Chris's brother, Jonathan. What would the brother of the accused murderer and the other son of the victim say? Jonathan is a naval lieutenant who was thousands of miles away when the crime took place. According to Jonathan, Chris told him the same story he told police, that he was passed out on the couch in his dorm building when the murder had taken place. He testified that the weapon looked similar to an axe the family had kept in the garage. He also confirmed that he and Chris knew that if their parents ever died, they would become beneficiaries of their estate.
Right. And on the stand, while Jonathan didn't turn on Chris, he inferred that he and Chris were estranged and their relationship was highly strained. He said his dad was amazing, a hardworking guy who loved the law, law-abiding, good father. Mother, he sang equally positive praises. According to Spotlight News, in the courtroom, Jonathan never looked at Chris during his entire testimony. There was definitely an icy feeling between the two of them. And the jury was later questioned. They said that this icy relationship, this very strained dynamic, was just one more piece of the puzzle for them, a cherry on top of all of the other evidence that prosecutors presented. What they had in front of them was proof that Chris burglarized his family's home on multiple occasions. He burglarized his employers. He lied. He cheated. He forged documents, took out lines of credit against his parents' name. He did all of this to maintain appearances with his college friends, to impress fellow students. He lied constantly. There were surveillance footage, stolen items in his possession, eBay accounts connected to him, proving he sold these items. All of them were pieces of the puzzle that were right there to be put together, dots to be connected.
After closing arguments from both sides, the jury went out to deliberate. And on August 10th, after 21 days in court, the jury found Chris guilty of second-degree murder and attempted murder. Months later, a judge sentenced Chris to 46 years behind bars, and he would be up for parole in December of 2052. The judge also said, quote, "I fear very much what happened in the early morning hours of November 15th is something that could happen again." Chris was taken to the Clinton Correctional Facility to start serving his sentence.
His attorney started working on an appeal immediately, although they wouldn't get very far. The appellate in the New York State Court of Appeals upheld the lower court's conviction and rejected his appeals. So Chris actually took his case all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. But the court decided the evidence had proved he was guilty beyond any reasonable doubt.
Right, but just because the trial was over didn't mean that people would lose interest. So Lifetime, the network, released a film called, quote, "Romeo Killer, the Chris Porco Story." I mean, I'm not sure where this Romeo thing
I know.
Came from, but
what is
I mean, razzle dazzle, I guess, that's show business. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really track here, but according to Chris, it was at least 80% false. And this portrayal apparently also presented Joan as a liar. So Chris's lawyer filed a lawsuit against the network under Section 51 of the state's civil rights law, which prevents use of a non-consensual living person's name, portrait, or photo for either advertising or trade. But in the suit, they claimed 11 of 12 scenes involving Joan were false because she testified during the trial of having no memory of the attack.
So Lifetime argued that their film was based on a true story, which qualifies it as a fictional piece, not a documentary or a news program. And they went on to tell the judge that the case could threaten protected speech for thousands of films and books in New York. At one point, a judge granted an injunction to stop the film from airing. But after several appeals and judges later, in June of 2021, Chris ultimately lost his court battle against the network. And five appellate justices ruled Chris's legal team could not provide sufficient proof that Lifetime's claims were inaccurate. Especially since the family would have firsthand knowledge of the events, the judge felt that they should be able to produce concrete evidence against the film's claims.
This guy was going to deny his role in this until the day he died. And it's a good thing he's going to be stuck behind bars for a long time. But as much as we believe he is where he belongs, we can't help feel for Joan. Joan lost so much. She lost her husband, she lost her son, and she's living with these injuries that she suffered during the attack. And with so much evidence implicating her son in Peter's murder and her own attack, we have to ask, how do we feel about sticking by Chris to the bitter end?
She's got to know, but I think her maternal instincts just overpower her reason.
I mean, yeah, she's lost everything.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine being in her position. And if you come to terms with that, then what do you have left? Really?
It's just too painful. It's like, can I really, she'd lose everything. And like, I think the idea, it's too painful to be like, right now she has a relationship with him probably from behind bars.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and like
something
for her,
to hold on
this
to.
Is better. than having to cut him off and like deal with the truth.
Yeah.
Well, and even if she's like fighting for his innocence, at least she has something to fight for. You know what I mean? Rather than just accepting it and then there's nothing.
Definitely. So. And can you imagine being Alex? Okay, so it's been a while since we've heard from our first degree because, you know, she's watching this from a vantage point. She's at college and she's like, oh my God, I almost went out with this guy. I knew this guy all through high school. And it's shocking to be connected to somebody like this. So we asked her what she thought of all of it.
It's really heartbreaking to me because I really do feel like it is a prime example of cognitive dissonance. Like if she fully admitted that that her son, her baby boy, was the guy who did this, like her entire world would crumble and she would have nothing left, you know? Like how do you live with the fact that your child, your baby, murdered his father, your husband, and still like move on with your life?
Chris's murder plot was meticulously and maliciously planned. And the fact that he believed that the lives of his parents were worth less than taking responsibility for some debt he racked up demonstrates the true depth of his evil.
All right, well, thank you. Huge, huge thank you to Alex for being our first degree guest for the last two episodes. If you're out there listening and you have a first degree story to tell, you can email us, hello@thefirstdegreepodcast.com. Follow us on Instagram @thefirstdegree, @AlexisLinkletter, @BillyJensen, @JackVanik. Join our Facebook group. We're talking true crime all the time and sometimes not true crime. And stick around tomorrow because a brand new episode of Killing Time will be dropped in your first degree feed.
And remember, only you can prevent serial killers. Keep your friends close.
But not that close.
What day was it? Happy Hamburger Day.
Happy Hamburger. Wow. Ooh, Cheeseburger Day. I don't do hamburgers, bro.
Day. Happy Cheeseburger Day.
Bye. Shout out to Jared Monaco for scoring and creating original music for The First Degree, producing by Caitlin Cleveland, producing an additional writing by Taylor Rogers and Alan Santiago for Podcast One. Sources for this episode include The Times Union, ABC News, CBS News, Troy Record, and The Saratogian. And as always, our first degree guest is always our largest source. Bye.